I think that I will do something which I don't think should establish any kind of tradition, and that's run a little bit later, because I thought I would have a bit more time with this notice. It's now more than 30 years since the initial discovery of the pulsar. It's over 65 years, I think, since the proposal that the remnant star of the supernova explosion, the Crab, from 1054 AD, was indeed a neutron star. And considering when this subject began, it's rather surprising in some ways that there are still so many unsolved problems which are getting in the way of understanding them. Some of these problems concern what goes on well outside of the neutron star surface. There's the mother of all problems. Why do we get all this coherent radio emission that enables us to identify a radio pulsar? And that's still, I think, among the unsolved problems. There's certainly no consensus on this. One might say it's an easy problem because there are lots of answers, but there's certainly no agreement on what's going on. There are other kinds of pulsars. There are gamma ray pulsars, which in a few cases seem able to convert almost 100% of the spin down power of the star into gamma rays. In fact, if you believe the observers, it's a bit more than 100%. So it's a problem. The other group of problems concern what happens inside of the neutron star, and in particular those things which would be happening inside of a neutron star which could be observable as affecting what happens on the surface of a neutron star, so that there is some possibility of observational consequences. One way of looking deep into the star is perhaps through gravitational radiation, and these problems and all modes and so on will be discussed, I think, by Lars next week. So I won't touch on any of those. So our own ITP workshop is concerned mainly with spin and magnetic fields in young neutron stars, and I'm going to just talk about things that are related just to that. We'll start in a very elementary way with what is agreed upon about the structure of a neutron star. In principle, it shouldn't be hard, because a neutron star is really just a giant nucleus. And if you take a nucleus and keep increasing its atomic number and atomic weight, so it keeps getting bigger and bigger, and not worrying about the fact that it will fission, it will take together in some arbitrary way, then the nucleus will get bigger, and the electron cloud around the nucleus will get smaller, and by the time you get up to a proton number Z of order 1,000, the external cloud around the nucleus will have been soaked completely inside of the nucleus. It will have a Fermi energy, something like 100 million electron volts. That's a rather high Fermi energy. And so the protons will begin to eat the electrons with weak interactions and convert them to neutrons. And so this object really is mainly neutrons. But neutrons don't have enough attraction to overcome the kinetic energy you have to pay to keep them at nuclear densities, and so you can't make a light neutron star. It will just blow apart. And it is not until gravity really becomes important, which is around a tenth of the mass of the Sun, that the gravity is strong enough to hold together a nuclear density of neutrons. The neutron-neutron attraction is important, but not strong enough to hold the star together all by itself. So, in first approximation, the neutron star is a collection of nuclei and neutrons making some kind of a giant nucleus. Now, the density of stars, typically, if they have about the mass of the Sun, will vary from about 10 to the 15th or so grams per cubic centimeter at the center. That's about five times or so the density inside of the nucleus, and they will ultimately fall off to zero density at the surface of the star. And one thing that one can say about such a collection of neutrons, which is quite robust, is that they will be a superfluid. You have attraction at the top of the Fermi seed, the attraction is very strong. And so all of these exponentials of minus one over a small number that always come into the BCS calculations in terrestrial condensed matter are not nearly as sensitive to the exponent as they are in the laboratory. And you can really predict with a certain amount of comfort what the BCS gap energy should be in the neutron superfluid, which is inside of a typical neutron star, which has nuclear density, which has a radius of something like 10 kilometers. The calculations give you a number that looks something like this. This is a gap. It is not so big at 10 to the 13th cubic centimeters rise. It could be something over an MeV at 4 or 5 times 10 to the 13th centimeter. And then begins to drop off because you have a short range repulsion involved when you look at the interaction between centrifuges. But the triplet P J equal 2 state P-waves is sufficiently attractive, given another BCS gap, it looks something like that, it's smaller than the first one, and so it looks about like this, the PD gap. And there are uncertainties in the theoretical calculations which you can smear with something of that sort. But it's not something which is the big problem in understanding what's going on inside of the neutron. The transition temperature into the superfluid state comes about when the temperature is of order of magnitude in MeV, that corresponds to about 10th degrees Kelvin. That is very hot compared to the internal temperature of any known neutron star. So the interior of the neutron star is really cold relative to the superconducting transition temperature. The neutron star is going to be spinning. In periods of known neutron stars, goes anywhere from 1.6 milliseconds for the fastest spin so far identified to something I think like 1,000 seconds for one of the so-called accreting X-ray pulsars. Perhaps there's an even slower one by now. So it's a big range of periods that's involved. And as I think everyone in the room knows, that when we spin a superfluid, a neutral superfluid, it only spins by establishing an array of quantized vortex lines. The quantization circulation is the same as it would be in helium 4 or in helium 3. And the number density of these vortex lines, that I'm spinning around, I'm going to have an array of vortex lines. And the number density of vortex lines, and maybe it's just the angular spin rate, the number density of vortex lines is going to be something like 1,000 divided by the period in seconds per square centimeter. So a young radio pulsar, 10 to the 4th, maybe even somewhat more, vortex lines per square centimeter are established when the neutron star is spinning. And again, for the experts in the audience in BCS, we're speaking about BCS pairs, which are around 10 to the minus 12th centimeters in size. So the spacing between vortex lines is enormous compared to the correlation mix. It's part of these problems. When you spin up a neutron star, the vortex array must contract. When you spin it down, the vortex array must expand. There's no other way that you can spin down the neutron superfluid. One determines the other. Spinning down, which would be the main concern, I think, in what goes on for the young neutron stars, the vortex array is moving outward. If you know the rate of spinning down, you know the rate at which the vortex lines must be moving outward. Now, the first complication comes in because it's not pure neutrons. With the pure neutrons, clearly you could lower the energy state by converting some of those neutrons to electrons and an equal number of protons. So you lower if they weren't interacting with Fermi energy until the neutrons can no longer go into protons plus electrons plus antineutrinos. And protons plus electrons will not go into neutrons plus neutrinos. So by adjusting the chemical potentials, you get a certain number of protons that must be mixed in with the neutrons. That number is not a particularly large number. It's a border 3 or 4%. It's a bit bigger at the center, a bit smaller on the outside, but it's that kind of a number. Now, these protons will form a charged superconductor, they'll form a superconductor, they attract at the top of the Fermi scene. And this is a harder problem, however, to have a reliable calculation as to when this will occur, because when you look at the neutrons attracting the neutrons, you can ignore the protons, and it's a pure neutron problem. When you look at what happens to the protons attracting the protons interact with the neutron theory, the neutrons will interact with the protons, and you really have to do a more complicated many-body problem, and it's not in as good a shape as it is in determining what this curve looks like or what this curve looks like. It's, even though the fundamental interactions are the same, it is reduced by the polarization effects by a factor of 2 or 3 or 4 or something of that sort. So the proton superconductivity comes in with a gap that looks something like this. So as you cool a neutron star, first thing that will happen very quickly, will happen probably in minutes, is that some of the neutrons in the outer part of the star, that's much less than the nuclear density, which is around there, will begin to become superfluid. Then the protons will begin to become superconducting. Then the core neutrons, the deeper, more deeply buried neutrons, will finally become superfluid. This will take place on a time scale of minutes, hours. This will take place certainly within, almost certainly within a year, maybe a decade, and this may take centuries to be accomplished. Again, the Crab supernova is 1054, so that's 10 centuries ago. And that's one among the very youngest of the identified neutron stars. Now, the next approximation one has to start to worry about the fact that...
Say a word about what the electrons do.
The electrons form a C with a Fermi energy about 100 MeV by themselves. They're almost inert. They have some role, in, which I'll come back to, in conductivity inside the core, but I don't think they do anything in this particularly interesting kind of phenomenon. It's a pretty stiff C.
What is the Fermi energy of the neutron?
Well, if you turn off the interaction, it depends where you are, but if you're around nuclear density, it's something like 30 MeV. Now, there are questions.
What happens in the screening length?
I'm sorry? I'll tell you what the screening length looks like in the place where it seems to make a difference. But let me come back to that. I want to talk to you about clumping the protons in a little while. There are real questions about what happens at the center of the star. In part driven, I think, by the quantum chromodynamic community was looking for an application for very nice physics. For example, you have neutrons, you have electrons that are coupled with Fermi energy, and you have protons. And these are just the energies of the various particles that they want to interact with.
It was 100 MeV.
I'm sorry?
You said the electron is 20 MeV. And the neutron is 30.
That's because when I gave you the answers, it's taking into account all the nuclear interactions.
So
this is not if I turned off all the interactions.
And that would then be 30?
If I turned off all nuclear interactions, it's that whatever corresponds to a density of... one or two times 10 to 14 grams. My memory was that in the nucleus it's around 10. I turned off the interactions, obviously. These would be about the same. These are the two. It may pay to replace most of the electrons by K minus mesons. Even though they're massive, they have a strong attraction to baryons, and so you have the possibility, instead of having neutrons, protons, and electrons, you may make a transition in which it pays to have some ordered phase of neutrons and protons, and the baryon would flip isotopic spin into a minus system. And to go in a little further, or perhaps instead of this, you could have just a quark bag, up and down quarks, may be a more appropriate way of describing that. If you go to still higher densities, the fact that the strange quark has a heavier mass than the up and down quarks becomes less important. You can start to think about mixtures of up-down and strange quarks with this color flavor locking, these have their own exotic properties. Roughly speaking, all of these should also be, when you look beyond the lowest order approximation, some kind of superfluid. So there's a certain uncertainty about what's going on here in any neutron star. Maybe it's important in the heaviest neutron stars, maybe it's not important at all. Maybe some say it completely dominates the neutron star, in which case we're using the wrong name and it should be called a string star. I'm going to take the old-fashioned view that a neutron star is appropriately named. It consists mainly of neutrons and it has a minority content of protons and electrons. And only worry about that because that's enough of a worry. The next thing we have to worry about is the breakdown of the homogeneity of the system. We have neutrons, protons, and electrons. When you get out near the surface of the star, the proton number density begins to fall so much, its Fermi energy begins to fall so much, that the Fermi energy does not overwhelm the energy of nuclear attractions. The protons begin to clump. You get nuclei. The proton clumps suck in neutrons. They really resemble neutron-rich nuclei, in between which you are filled with a neutron superfluid. So it's nuclei filled with neutron superfluid, and you don't reach conventional matter, which is just electrons and nuclei, awfully close to the edge of the surface, where it's not clear that it would make much difference whether that particular energy out of area exists or not. The nuclei, where when they're too close, have a Coulomb repulsion, and how nuclei see their neighboring nuclei depends upon what the screening length is going to be between nuclei. The screening length, when you calculate in these regions, is considerably greater than the separation between the nuclei. And I'm trying to remember what the number is, and it's much more than 10 to minus 12 centimeters, and it gets up to 10 to minus 11 centimeters, some number of that sort, up toward the edge of the star, where the Fermi energy is still maybe 80 MeV or thereabouts. It's that kind of a number. It looks like a short screening radius, but the separation between nuclei is really even closer because we're speaking of densities of 10 to the 12th, 10 to the 13th, even 10 to the 14th grams. The nuclei interact with each other, repel each other. In first approximation, it is a good example of nature realizing a Coulomb lattice. One thing that you can calculate about this assemblage of nuclei is the temperature at which they will form a lattice. That is, what is the melting temperature of the lattice which these would form at zero temperatures? And that melting temperature, not corrected for a small correction because it's screening, is going to be the charge in the nucleus, dV square, over some pure number gamma, times the separation between nuclei. Here's the nuclei. It should form a body center through the lattice. Charge Z, separation, and that number turns out to be about 10 of the 10 Kelvin, about the same kind of number as we have here. So Z is going to be one of the magic numbers for the protons, and it's not so clear whether it's going to be 40 or 30, I don't know what they are, 30 or 40. So you can make a reasonably good estimate of the melting temperature of the crust. And when I add it to the others, it sounds like here's a neutron star, probably born very hot, cools very quickly. The first things to happen are the crust starts to solidify at about the same time as the neutron superfluid in that crustal region begins to become superfluid. Then the protons in the crust are all nuclei, but the protons in the core will become superconducting. Then the neutrons in the core will become superfluid, and we're ignoring whether there is any particular core of a core that has to be given special attention. If it is unlikely that the transition temperature, the superfluidity, would not be much greater than numbers of this sort. That's the sort of things you just estimate in the back of the envelope. If the phase exists, it should become superfluid at quite a high temperature. Okay.
So, this lattice of nuclei, how deep does that extend?
The lattice of nuclei extends in, I'm sorry, I should have said that. The lattice of nuclei extends in, its thickness is about a kilometer. About 10% of the radius of it.
Is that competing with the superfluidity there, or is it coexisting?
Well, as far as the neutrons are concerned, they're just spread out and clumpy in here, so they're still superfluid. The protons, in a way, are still a superconductor inside the nuclei, but the nuclei happen to have a size which is smaller than the correlation length. So the nuclear physicists have different words for these things. They're called pairing energies and so on. But the nuclei act as if they are very tiny bits of superconductor.
Okay, but you're saying in this crust, you have a lattice of nucleons which is sort of immersed or is penetrated with some superfluid.
With neutron superfluid, let's go like this. If I looked at a profile, I would find the following. Here's the density of neutrons. Here's the density of protons. And the density of neutrons would look something like this. In between the nuclei is a neutron sink. When you have a nucleus, there's a higher density neutron sink. That's what the density looks like in the crust. Neutrons are certainly a superfluid. These neutrons talk to those neutrons. These protons have an awfully hard time talking to these protons. The barrier penetration is really not important. So they like isolated bits, if you want to think of that way, of superconductor. So these are little diamagnets.
It's a little bit like fission, isn't it? If you think, if you just as a thought experiment, start from all the protons collected together, then obviously a pair doesn't work. They have to disintegrate. And then once there are fragments, this is such a lattice, is the electrostatically most favorable.
Yeah, of course, problems as to these things. You may think that a year is a long, or a day is a long time to cool, but in some ways it isn't. It's not clear they ever really get to their lowest state of free energy. There could be all kinds of fluctuations that get frozen out. Now, for lots of reasons, one wants to know as much as one can about properties of the crust. Among other reasons, it's a screen between you and what's going on inside the star. If the crust never reacted in any way, you might have trouble, or you might be happy to be able to avoid lots of things that are happening inside the star. Young is a rather arbitrary word. I think by young we will probably mean in this study certainly young compared to a million years, and probably not much older as a rule than 10,000 years. On time scales of that sort, the crust is an extraordinarily good electrical conductor. It really is going to freeze in any magnetic field that it has. If you want to change the magnetic field in the crust, you've got to move matter around in the crust in some way, probably. One can calculate things like the shear modulus of the crust with a very considerable amount of confidence. One would like to know things like the thermal conductivity of the crust. Probably one can do a pretty good job on that. One would like to know something about the strength of the crust and how it responds when its yield, maximum yield, when its yield stress is reached. What does it do? Neutral stress is reached. If it's above about a tenth or so of its melting temperature, but if it is anything like terrestrial matter, it will have plastic flow and relieve excess stress that way. When it gets below that, you would like to know, is it brittle? Is it going to relieve its stress in sudden events like cracks? Is it going to release its energy in relatively sudden events, meaning over periods like ours? Perhaps it will continually have plastic flow. That's one of the deep problems, I think, about conclusions about neutron stars, in which one just doesn't really know. A usual theory of how cracks are formed, you open a crack, you make more surface area, you relieve stress, it's just not going to work inside of these crusts because they are squeezed so hard, you don't open up anything. You may be slipping, but you certainly don't open new surface as you would in normal matter. if you try to ask your metallurgy colleagues, you'll have to be prepared to answer questions like, would you anneal the star? Clearly, it's a hard problem, because it really is a question of what's the dislocation structure inside of the lattice crystal, and how does it behave? One would like to know, and I hope somebody can give an answer, but I think it's an unknown question. Yes.
Is this a strong conclusion about the
I haven't said anything like that. I just know that it's almost a perfect conductor. And that the conductivity is very high, and the eddy diffusion time through it is going to be huge compared to the time scales of interest in the early life of the neutron star.
Speaking about this cluster problem and the lattice, that's of course a classical mechanics problem. Strain of the neutron star, you run laterally. And so that is so susceptible to a very effective classical simulation. Such answers as what happens if there are no cracks, what does happen, those things have been. For other systems, very well.
Well, I've seen there's a lot of literature on propagation of cracks and things of that sort. But you have to start with some notion of what the dislocation structure is like in some things. And I'm not saying that it's poorly understood, but I can say what you'll find in the literature. You will find extremes that say the whole crust is one perfect crystal because it started to solidify somewhere and it just slowly spread around. The statements that Noah's consists of microcrystals whose characteristic dimension is 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. But that's a big variation from 10 to the 5th centimeters. I think you'll have to know something about what the dislocations are like in this particular object. I should mention also that different kinds of neutron stars have very different scenarios for how the mass inside of them is accumulated. But even in the early days of a neutron star, you might have a hot object that's cooling, you might have a hot object that's cooling, and then matter is falling also onto the surface from the outside. So, if the answer is known, that's great. But I think the answer is not so known to the people who should know the answer.
No, I don't think the answer is known, but I think it's knowable.
Well, the normal assumption is that the yield stress is going to be the yield that corresponds to a dimension of strain of order about 10 to the minus 3. That's about the sign of number you get if you look up in the handbooks of any kind and say, when did something. That's the number that's generally assumed. 10 to the minus 3, it might be 10 to the minus 4, it might be 10 to the minus 5. That kind of thing. If it was an ideal crystal, it would be 10 to the minus, what is it? It's a 20th, I guess, it's minus.
Does any of this information about the properties of the crust come from observations?
Well, I'll show you the observations. That's a good question. And some of it used to the people who try to explain it for that question.
Tom Loveland had this expression as whatever happened to yes and no. Excuse me for a second. Is the answer yes?
You want my personal answer? The answer is absolutely yes. There are observations which actually give you a clue as to this.
So you can see crust plates or something.
Well, you can see, I think, some evidence of crust motion, which is rather sudden. It took place over an interval less than an hour. Okay, now, I want to take one last point before starting to talk about the dynamics of what's going on in there. The interaction between neutrons in the neutron superfluid and protons in the proton superconductor is velocity dependent. If you have a proton moving through a neutron sea of nuclear densities, its effective mass is not the bare mass. It's something, depends on what the density is of the neutron matter, but it's something of order 6/10, 7/10 or so of what the bare mass would be. And that's a measure of the velocity dependence of the interaction, or if you wish, of the forward scattering amplitudes, velocity dependence. If I have a vortex, I'm looking down on it, then I have a velocity of neutrons around the vortex, it's the phi direction, which is h bar over twice the mass of the neutron, the radius of which I'm looking. I have another high velocity of neutrons in near the center of the vortex. The neutrons interact with the protons, and you cannot solve the problem of what is the motion of the superconductor and superfluid without solving the joint problem. And obviously, the protons are going to start to partake in the motion of the neutrons, and will go in the opposite direction, but they're going to begin to move when the neutron superfluid begins to move, if you're trying to make the lowest energy system that's compatible with what a vortex must be. Whatever description you like to have for it.
I'm saying that in helium light, sometimes you can have the core be a different superfluid than the bulk outside.
Well, I don't know what the answer is. I can only tell you what most people assume. They take a kind of Landau-Ginzburg theory and the gap delta goes to zero. So it's like saying it's more about the very center. It gradually goes over. So that's the usual approximation. So it's a non-local problem approximate is a local one, for the reasons in which you're uncomfortable about doing it. On the other hand, there are no experiments in the astrophysics building in neutron stars, so people are not as uncomfortable as perhaps they should be. This is going to imply the velocity of protons. Protons are taking this motion out to a distance of roughly the London length, which is a number of about 10 to minus 11 centimeters in these systems. And we're all done. The neutron vortex has protons around it. It is a magnetic solenoid that is established around the core of the vortex, within which the magnetic field is about 10 to the 15th Gauss. And that will be important in a little while. So if I look at a neutron vortex line, it's got a solenoid around it. And inside the solenoid is about 10 to the 15 Gauss, and the radius of the solenoid is a number like 10 to the 11 centimeters. It's a good fraction of the quantized flux unit of 2 times 10 to the minus 7 Gauss centimeters square. And it's no particular number. There's no fundamental reason that it's any special number times. It chooses to calculate whether you get some fraction. Okay, now,
the superconducting, I mean, the protons are circulating around as well, around this vortex and neutron.
Out to a distance of where the 10 miles of other things.
And the flux is not, the magnetic flux is not quantized?
No.
Then, how is that possible if it's a condensed?
Well, you have to listen. If you have in your original Lagrangian, say, terms involving Vn minus Vp squared plus 1 plus. The relationship between momentum and velocity is not what you grew up to learn.
Yeah.
And it's the momentum that gets quantized, and then what does that say about the velocities? You don't have the usual, you have to go back to the first principle. It's not hard, and repeat it all. Okay, now, the last point in the structure. I'm not going to be able to get the unit in there.
I'm a student.
Student? Yeah. I haven't had lunch yet. Okay. The last feature of setting up the object before worrying about what its dynamic is going to be is the magnetic field which a neutron star will carry. Let's put aside the question of where did that magnetic field come from. Okay, to assume that our star has some kind of a magnetic dipole moment, with a dipole field times the cube of the radius of the star, with a magnetic dipole moment, zipping around. If it was doing that in a vacuum, then we would say that the moment of inertia of the star times the time rate of change of its angular, of its spin rate, would be equal to some number which has got some pi's in it. B, d, square of the dipole moment, and the omega cube, and c cube, this just follows dimensionally, that's the spin direct. So if you know what the moment of inertia is, equation of state is not well known, but it's not so poorly known that you're going to be off by more than a factor and say 2 or something of that sort in this. This is something which you can measure. You can measure the period today, and then you can measure the period a little while later and see what the change in period is, get the PDT. One thinks one knows roughly what the radius is. This is measured. Get the dipole moment. And if it really wasn't a vacuum, this would be the perpendicular component of the dipole moment. That's probably a rather robust formula. The actual star, which is rotating, is not surrounded by a vacuum. It carries in its magnetosphere, in the magnetic field, which it's forcing to rotate, plus the electron ion plasma, which is embedded in the magnetosphere. It's a more complicated structure than just the star would have if it was in a bare state. But it's hard to see why there should be big quantum mechanical corrections to that. It's hard to see how the pull of gravity is going to make any difference in this. And sort of almost stuck with this kind of thing just for dimensional reasons. If only the dipole moment makes a difference, and these spin rates are such that it's hard to see how quadrupole moments are going to come in. It's going to be a formula of this sort, but maybe you should have added into it another term which depends on the parallel component of the dipole moment, with perhaps a different numerical coefficient. But this is what we generally assumed by the community when they say that the magnetic dipole moment has been measured. It is really a definition of what the dipole moment is, putting in accepted values, which are not particularly controversial for I, and the radius of the star. Okay? Now, when you do that, you find that there are big families of neutron stars that are claimed to exist. Some of them certainly do exist. They're the common radio pulsars in which this number tends to be, I guess, 10 to the 11th gauss at the very low end, 10 to the 13th gauss. These are the common radio pulsars. A birth rate may be one a century, one every 2 centuries or something. There are the magnetars, which are certainly going to be a subject discussed at the conference, at the workshop a lot. Magnetic fields, 10 to the 14th gauss at least, maybe more typically 10 to the 15th gauss. They have a moon, so they must exist, and they can't be born at a rate of maybe one every 10,000 years. I will mention in passing only because there is clearly a bit of literature on models based upon magnetic fields in neutron stars above 10 to the 15th gauss, maybe even to 10 to the 17th gauss. You could hold in 10 to the 18th gauss. Gravitational pull is strong enough to do that. Sometimes those models are associated by the modeler with gamma ray burst sources, and they might have a birth rate of order 1 every million years. Millisecond pulsars have measured magnetic fields, periods, milliseconds, magnetic fields, 10 to the 8th, maybe 10 to the 9th, somewhere in that range. There are millisecond pulsars which have higher magnetic fields, but they're not near milliseconds, they're tens of milliseconds. Birth rate may be 1 every 10 to the 7th years. There is a possibility, maybe even a probability, that some neutron stars, maybe many neutron stars, some propose most neutron stars, have magnetic fields of less than 10 to the 8th gauss. Earth radars are known, but it might be something like this in this form. But they probably don't exist because they have no name yet. The workshop, I think, is going to be concentrating the subject is spin and magnetic fields in young neutron stars. Probably mainly because there'll be some discussion of this. Now, what is the magnetic field? This is a measure of the outside magnetic field. if you presume that that magnetic field is also characteristic of what exists inside the neutron star, what does the magnetic field do inside the neutron star? And that depends on looking a little harder about the nature of the superconductor. And again, for the experts, I will just say that the calculations indicate that at least in the electron, at least in the proton superconducting fluid just below the crust, it is probably a type 2 superconductor. The correlation length is considerably less than the Lambda K. But not by such a comfortable margin that it would be revolutionary if that wasn't true. So it's probably type 2 below the crust. It might be type 2 all the way in, or it might turn into a type 1 superconductor. I will assume it is a type 2 superconductor because it's just not enough time to go into all the possibilities. And that means that if we look at the magnetic field, here's the crust, here's the core, that the magnetic field bunches into quantized flux tubes. The flux in the quantized flux tube is exactly the same as the flux in the quantized flux tube in an electron superconductor. So usually 2 times 10 to the minus 7 centimeters squared. The radius of that flux tube is again the London screening length, so only about 10 to the minus 11 centimeters. So the magnetic field inside this is a number like 2 times 10 to the 15th caps. Usually magnetized, quite small.
So is Zeeman splitting a worry when you think about
the life inside 2 times 10 to the 15th caps? I have an experience that I...
current particles, right? You like to have time reversal symmetry, right? So, it's a huge magnetic field.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of physics associated with this. I'll just tell you one of the things that has been looked at a lot in just a moment. The number density of such flux tubes. The number density of such flux tubes, let's see, I'm going to have time somewhere here. Is... Well, it's not so good. It's a number like 10 to the 19th times the magnetic field in units of 10 to the 12th Gauss. That's the average magnetic field in the center of the scale. You recall that the number density of vertex lines is about 10 to the 5th. It's a huge number density array of magnetic flux tubes. The star, before it went into the superconducting transition, was at least hydromagnetically stable. So undoubtedly, it had toroidal field as well as poloidal field. So it's a complicated magnetic field with a huge number of flux lines, embedded in which there are these magnetized vortex lines. That's the neutron star in the simplest version. Ignoring complications of cause and things of that sort. Now, the star has a dipole moment and it's spinning down. The crust taps the magnetic field, it starts to spin down. You've got all these flux tubes that are anchored in the crust. Permanently anchored, let's think of the crust for a moment as really being a rigid solid for a moment. The vertex lines clearly are co-rotating with the crust. All the charge components are co-rotating together with the neutron vertex lines and the flux lines. But the neutron superfluid in the crust and in the core are not going to participate in that slowdown until they move outward to their desired position. There's no other way they can stay down. And there's a lot of force on them telling them to get out where they belong. So here's the first problem. And at this point, I should say, up to now, I think that I've been giving you a description which is kind of a consensus description.
Why is there a consensus? You speak as if these things are facts. And that, you know, certainly a neutron superfluid.
Well, I didn't say it was a fact. I said it was a consensus.
No, and I'd like to try to understand that because, you know, these are obviously extremely strongly interacting systems. Right. And so, the evidence that it's actually a supercooler of neutrons even comes from calculations of BCS type.
No, that's not completely fair. I think there's a lot of evidence for identifying the gap in nuclei. Not the same calculation, because the correlation length of movement there certainly is a gap in nuclei. That's the best one can do.
Okay. How do you know it's not four neutrons forming a something?
Well, four neutrons doesn't have much interaction. You can't get a structure in nature of four neutrons that holds together.
I guess one question that would be of interest to our group, I guess, maybe, is this a strongly correlated system in the sense that we think of strongly correlated systems? I mean, for instance, where the, well, I'm trying to think what the criteria would be for this, particularly things like the coherence line compared to the Fermi wave vector to be small.
No, the coherence length is much bigger than the Fermi vector.
So it's a, it's weak coupling system. Okay, so this is weak coupling superconductor. That's a very good conventional.
I'm claiming, however, that the calculations of what neutrons do, because their interactions are so strong, the dineutron is almost bound. It's just a bare accident that it isn't bound. You make the well a little deeper, it's bound. That's how strong the coupling is. Just pull that part of that pair out of the sea. It is almost bound. It's a virtual state. I forgot what it is. Well, somebody else knows, 500 kilovolts, something. It's almost bound. It really is strong.
If it's almost bound, why isn't the coherence length on the scale of the separation between neutrons? But that's, I mean, in...
Well,
I mean, helium 4 is bound.
Yeah, because the Fermi energy is 30 MeV. It's costs you a lot.
The size of deuteron is much, much larger. Because the
almost zero.
Yeah. All right. So you can think of it as an S-wave scattering length if you wanted to, except to change the sign. Right. So you know, when things are marginally bound.
But you also must measure it next to the Fermi energy. Fermi energy is big enough, the attraction is not important. They give you well-compiled structures. Where's David? Give me a bam. I didn't know it's
good. Right, you have the basics pointed to
it. It's obvious the title of my talk has to be Neutron Stars, the Outside Story.
You can say Neutron Stars, the True Story. Anyway. The vortex lines are moving out. They entangle these flux tubes. What happens? A vortex line does not like to go through a flux tube. If they have a huge magnetic field, each one does, if the fields are roughly parallel, they'll repel each other. If the fields are roughly perpendicular, they will attract each other but not want to let go. Secondly, and it's really part of the same story, there's a velocity dependence in the nuclear force. So I have neutrons going around the vortex, protons going around the flux tube to establish the magnetic field there, and when you bring them near each other, the energy is a function of how close they are because of the velocity dependence of the nuclear. So the first thing one has to do is decide, is that interaction worth worrying about? And I think the answer is absolutely. It's a crucial thing. Okay, so now they're going to go through. What do they do? The flux tubes are embedded in an electron-proton plasma. Protons are superconductors. The electrons are not. If the electrons were a perfect conductor, that's very hard to push the electrons, the flux tubes, through the electron-proton plasma. It's the same problem as just pushing any magnetic field through a system which is not dissipated. You're going to get back currents and you're going to make it very, very difficult since it's impossible to do. This system is dissipated. It's dissipated in a funny way. Because you have all these flux tubes, in addition to the electron going around in a cyclotron orbit, which sees the average, which the cyclotron radius is much bigger than the separation between flux tubes. There's a lot of random contribution as they scatter off the flux tubes. So the existence of the flux tubes gives rise to an analog to ohmic dissipation. There is some dissipation that says if you push on vortex lines pushing out flux tubes, and don't try to push them too fast, you'll get enough dissipation so that you can make the flux tubes move as the vortex lines want them to. However, you've got to make that motion very slow. And it is not that slow in the youngest pulsars of interest, although it is that slow in typical pulsars. The second problem you'll run across is that if you have a lot of flux tubes and a vortex line is trying to push them, a vortex line is not a rigid bar. It has tension effectively along the bar, kinetic energy per unit length, and it can establish ripples in itself, and you can get instabilities in which the vortex line begins to bend, there's a certain amount of bunching of the flux tubes, and in the end, you have flux tubes, electrons, protons, in which they're embedded, all moving together, and in between these bunches, you can have backflow. And I think the bottom line is that the neutron vortex lines can move the flux tubes if you don't try to do it too rapidly. And not too rapidly embraces the cases of interest for all the identified radio pulsars. So, the neutron vortex expansion, because of the fact that the star is spinning down, goes on, pulls the flux tubes out with them, and one consequence of that is going to be that the dipole moments of neutron stars should change as their spin rate changes. And as you lower the spin rate, you take whatever pattern you had and move it outward. If it moves outward in a well-defined way, then the perpendicular component of the dipole moment is something you can predict. So this pattern, whatever it is, begins to stretch, it begins to move outward, but can't do that indefinitely, because it runs into the end of the star. So some of the expanding flux tubes have gone out as far as they can go, and others are still partaking in what's going on. If you try to do that to flux tubes, if you try to do that to flux tubes, they're anchored where they belong, but they were forced to move away from where they were born, and you introduce very big stresses in the crust. You introduce stresses which are certainly in excess of the maximum plausible yield strength of crustal material. So the outside magnetic field is going to more or less reflect what the interior magnetic field is doing. And so the star's dipole moment should be increasing in a well-defined way. That's the first point I want to make. The second is, if this is a bit cool and the crust is a bit brittle, if it cracks, then some part of this is going to be discrete events. You'll see sudden changes in the magnetic field. This is not identifying what happens in glitches, but that's what I want to do now. Well, I think I better go right to the answer. I'm allowed to present this because it's got some data on it.
On the top.
On the top. Okay. These dots are identified pulsars in the last Peter Manchester compilation. Ignore this because that's another talk. Right? That's these are older pulsars. Predictions of what the star should do based on these microscopic ideas is, here's a neutron star that's born, and its dipole moment, there's no reason for it to be changing in a dramatic way, until you reach the temperature, and it's old enough so that you finally have gotten superconducting protons as well as superfluid neutrons, and then the superfluid neutrons are pushing on the proton flux tubes and moving them outward, and then the dipole moment begins to increase. And that should happen until you reach the stage where a good fraction of that magnetic flux has gone out as far as it can go. I mean, it's not changing so much anymore. It's sort of getting down flat again. Ultimately, you will have pushed most of the flux out of the core into the basis of the crust. You have enormous stress. You have 10 to 15 gauss 10 and 15 volts is more magnetic field and more stress than the crust can bear, and you are not able to prevent ultimate reconvection. And then the crust is acting more and more like a fluid with respect to what you're expecting. And then you should start to be grounded like this. And then, at this point, one reaches the end of the workshop discussion. However, I want to mention certain observations. The stars are radio pulsars which are in supernova remnants. You know how old the supernova remnant is. You know that this is about, these are young neutron stars that haven't been around all that long. Not normally going to come down. They seem to be born with, at least those, a characteristic magnetic field that is bigger than most of the older radio pulsars. This is what the expected evolution should be of the dipole field. The blue arrows represent cases in which you can measure the period of the star, the spin rate, dt of the spin rate, and the second derivative of that. So in those cases, you should be able to be measuring directly how the dipole moment is changing the time. In all those cases, they tried to make the arrow rocking scale. They are moving in this direction. Now, if they continued to move in that direction, they would be ending up here somewhere. If they leveled off, they'd be ending here somewhere. The length of time, this thing at the bottom is period. The length of time you spend in any logarithmic period interval goes roughly like 1 over the period square. So if they, you see these, you should see 100 times more of them over here. Well, the selection effects, maybe if the velocity is less, the beams are narrower, or such that you wouldn't see 100 times less. But nevertheless, you don't see the descendants of these over here. You seem to see the dependence of these over here, but there's no absolute proof that you didn't make them over here. So, it's not in contradiction to that picture. The dipole moments increase, and then dipole moments decrease. It is from this region to that region. At this point, incidentally, the crust is sufficiently strong that no matter what you do in the core, the crust just holds the field of density. This would be the expected behavior if you're looking outside the star. This would be the expected behavior if you're able to see through the crust and the core of the star. It's more or less identical to around this region. Glitches, the so-called giant glitches in radio pulsars is seen in stars in this region. It is not seen, giant glitches are not seen to the left, giant glitches are not seen to the right, giant glitches are not seen to lower magnetic radio pulsars. Giant glitches, neural-type glitches, which I'll get to in a minute, are seen only in that particular region. So I want to just mention the question, the case of glitches, it will be almost all time. Here's a glitch in the Crab pulsar. What you do is you measure the period of the pulsar. You measure ddt of the period of the pulsar. You measure the second derivative. You can't do that in any pulsars at present. So this is one of four or five pulsars in which enough information seems to be available to measure this. And now, this is the frequency of rotation. This is delta mu, the difference between the frequency you measure and what you expected if you just said, I'm going to extrapolate knowing p the frequency dt in the second derivative. Okay, as long as nothing happens, it does just what it's expected to. And then there's a glitch. A glitch is defined as a sudden increase in angular frequency. You can hardly see it. It's only 2 parts in 10 to the 8th. Measure it, it's hard to see it in this curve. But the main thing that happened at the glitch was a change in spin down rate that continued for essentially 10 years. And then it did it again. There's the glitch, most of it healed, then it got another one. And there's a third one that's just not answered. The main thing that happens in the crab, the glitches of the crab puzzle is a permanent change in its spin down rate, an increase in its spin down rate, consistent with a jump in its magnetic dipole moment, whose magnitude is a few times 10 to minus 4, which is not all that far away from the 10 to minus 3 or so that one is using to say that's the amount of strain you can build up before you relax it with the crust. So that's a reason for wanting the crust to behave in a way in which you might have guessed. It's not even a good bit of that. But what one wants to explain on the glitches is this. Does that happen in all glitches? It's not possible, as far as I know, to know. If you say, does that happen in the giant glitches of the Nebula pulsar, which are 10 to 100 times stronger? It's not possible to know, because in the case of the crab, the healing from the glitch is finished within months, and then the next glitch comes in 10 years. In the case of Nebula, it takes years to heal, and the next glitch comes in 3 years. So you get the next glitch before the first one is healed, and you don't know if there's any residual at this time. And I think so far, this is the only case in which there's enough information to answer the question, is there any indication that in the glitch something has happened to the surface, and it is at least in this case consistent, in both sign and in magnitude to what one might have guessed. Now, unfortunately, one didn't guess this ahead of time. With a little bit of hindsight, I would have predicted it, type of thing. Okay.
Now,
yeah.
This happens once every 10 years. The craft fossil is only 1,000 years old. You may have changed the magnetic moment by a few percent. So,
that's right.
Not by a large factor.
In the case of the craft, you have to rely on the fact that it's still warm. It's mostly relaxing stress. Absolutely. Mostly relaxing stress by some other mechanism. It is somewhat mysterious, if you don't like that explanation, of why in the case of Vela, which is spinning down more slowly, whatever is happening should be happening at a slower rate, is glitching every 3 years. Vela is a pulsar which is 10,000 years old, which has a cooler surface than the crab, and has a glitch behavior in that it differs in that it has much larger glitches, and the glitches occur more often. In the case of Vela, it's okay. This much of the glitch every 3 years is just about right for 100% change in magnetic field, or 30% or something like that, in 10,000 years. let me just give you if I can find it. This is a compilation, 1985. There are more glitches on this, but adding in all the more recent data. But it doesn't change the conclusion. These are all of the sudden jumps in spin rate, divided by the spin rate. These are the ones in the crab. You'll notice the following, that as you look to pulsars which have periods which are longer and longer, they seem to continue to have crab-like glitches. Maybe a bit tendency to fall off, maybe not. But if you look at periods of 10 to minus 1 second to, let's call it 1 second, you see what are called giant glitches. Pulsars which have giant glitches may also have crab-like glitches. They don't really seem to be a tail of this distribution. They seem to be this kind of a glitch and the larger glitches. There's one case of the crab in which the glitch was resolved. People happen to be looking at it just when it glitched. And there's one case of Vela in which it was being looked at just when it glitched. What happened in the case of the crab with the period, suddenly there was a glitch. The glitch was not accomplished all at once. Good crack from the glitch came earlier and it gradually got up to its maximum. In less than a day, it gradually reached it. Vela glitches are bigger. and the resolved beam glitch, it didn't go up to where it should be. It came down from something much bigger. It looked like this. There were two indications that there was some qualitative difference in beamer-like glitches and card-like glitches. One is the magnitudes. You can have both kinds in the same pulse up. And the other is the single case of each family, which has been resolved, are quite different. Difference out of the magnitude, just their sign differences, which are hard to understand this description within this description. Now, I'll just end with a kind of picture that's leading to some research on this, and that's the following. The vertex lines are moving outward. A lot of strain develops in the crust. Crust lives. You get a jump in dipole moment. You'll also get a sudden decrease in the pull back on the vertex lines from the magnetic field. But suddenly released, relaxed a little bit, so the vertex lines can move out a little bit. When the vertex lines move out, the neutron superfluid spins down, and the neutron superfluid spins down, and the angular momentum conserving neutron star, the rest of the star has to spin up, and it should be accomplished with a little spin up. And you try to estimate what happens. The shape should look like this. The time scale is very hard to predict. The shape should look like this. And the magnitude should be something times 10 to minus 8. So maybe that's what's going on. It's just a core phenomenon. But the core vortices are not quite where they want to be. They're being pulled back by these flux tubes because the flux tubes are anchored in the crust, and the crust doesn't want to let go, and the crust lets go a little bit. As the vortex lines move out, if there's no magnetic field, the vertex lines move out, get smaller, and then they just disappear. But they're all wrapped in magnetic field, and the magnetic field doesn't want to go into the crust. It's such a good conductor, so they start to pile up out here. And that means that there's a little annulus out here in which these neutron star superfluid is spinning around at its birth rate, or at least it's spinning around at the rate it had when the superconductivity began in the flux tube. So it might be spinning now with a period of a tenth of a second, but it might have a little bit of superfluid that's still spinning around with an angular spin rate of some tens of milliseconds. And then there's the problem, how does that system ultimately relax? As you put more and more of these vortex lines here, which can't quite get out, you certainly will exceed the yield strength of the crust in this way also, in addition to the fact that you're still moving additional vortex lines down here. So there are a number of different varieties, there are a variety of different kinds of yield stress exceeding, and events which exceed the yield stress, that you would expect to occur in the neutron star as you spin it down, okay? From the piling up here to the pulling up here. And certainly a bit of work that's going to be done here on that particular way in which one might explain the other. Finally, I've avoided talking about the most common way of discussing glitches. And of course, we're going to hear more about it from Dr. Shibazaki later on in the week. But I'll just tell you what it is. Although it seems to me that it's in a lot of trouble. And that's the following. I have vortex lines in the crust. I have nuclei in the crust. Nuclei interact with vortex lines. So the question comes in, can nuclei pin vortex lines in the crust? So as you spin down, the neutron vortex lines in the crust have a hard time moving out, because they're pinned by the nuclei. This is not like the pinning phenomena in terrestrial matter, because there you're almost always dealing with a case in which the correlation length is huge compared to the size of an atom or the spacing between atoms, typically 10 to minus 5 centimeters, say, compared to 10 to minus 8 centimeters. Here we're dealing with vortex lines whose correlation length is comparable to the size of the nuclei, which is comparable to the spacing between the nuclei. And there are deep questions as to whether you can get enough pinning, so that even if you could understand the sudden pinning event, but then all of the sides aren't pinned at the same time. But it can give you the amount of spin-up you need to explain the so-called giant, you know, and it's certainly worth the attention, I would think, of the Salmas they community. And I think we'll hear more about that later in the week. I'm sorry, I'd have to eat.